Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. This is the last episode on our series on the Exxon Valdez disaster. Just past midnight on March 24th, 1989, the Exxon Valdez struck a reef in Prince William Sound. At first, hundreds of thousands of gallons of oil poured into the clear blue water. Then it was millions.
The supertanker bound for Long Beach, California, ran aground about 22 miles south of Valdez early Friday morning after loading a cargo of 1.25 million barrels from the Alaska pipeline. Oil poured into the sound at the rate of 20,000 gallons an hour for 12 hours.
At the time, the spill was the worst man-made ecological disaster in the country's history. Emergency workers and response teams were dispatched to the ship to contain the flow and clean up what oil they could.
A 5-mile-long oil slick is moving out to sea. Exxon is flying in 3 plane loads of cleanup crews from around the world to help contain the spill.
But you can't unspill what's been spilled. Even if you've got at your disposal the resources of the biggest energy company in the country, Exxon.
You have had some good luck and you don't realize it. You have Exxon. And we do business straight. We will consider whatever it takes to keep you whole.
The Exxon Valdez spill, now 30 years old, changed the lives of everyone in the communities of Valdez, Cordova, and surrounding areas. As a result of the spill, industry regulations changed, shipping got safer, and yet, oil spills continue.
You have information now that this rig has gone under?
It has gone under the surface at about 10:21 this morning. Coast Guard got word that the vessel has gone under, and just recently we got word that the fire visibly has gone out.
In 2010, thousands of miles away from Prince William Sound in the Gulf of Mexico, a deepwater drilling rig operated by BP exploded. 210 million gallons of oil spilled, dwarfing the 11 million of the Exxon Valdez. On today's show, I'll be talking to two guests to discuss the impacts of the Exxon Valdez oil spill on the environment and our laws, then and now, 30 years later. First up is Rick Steiner, Cordova fisherman and a marine conservation professor with the University of Alaska. In our series, we featured his work in response to the Exxon Valdez spill, helping to bridge the gap between the scientific community and the local fishermen. Rick spoke to me from an Alaska public media studio in Anchorage, Alaska. Here's our conversation. American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. Rick Steiner, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Now, even before the spill in 1989, you were worried about the possibility of a spill in Prince William Sound. What caused your concern?
Well, just the fact that the pipeline had been built across Alaska to a marine terminal in Prince William Sound and all of this oil being hauled by single-hulled tankers through Prince William Sound was an obvious risk. The fishermen of Prince William Sound actually knew about this risk back in the early 70s and objected to the whole construction project. They wanted it built across to Canada and kept in pipelines rather than in super tankers going through Prince William Sound. And even several years prior to Exxon Valdez, we knew that there was a risk of a large oil spill. And I tried to establish a Citizens Advisory Council that would provide stakeholders, fishermen, Alaska Native peoples, communities, NGOs, an oversight role to help government and industry be safer. And the oil industry didn't want it, and the state government and federal government didn't want it at the time. So we were unsuccessful. And I still believe to this day that had we been successful establishing that citizens' oversight capability prior to the Exxon Valdez, it likely never would have happened because we would have seen the risks and fixed them.
What was your suspicion of tankers as opposed to a pipeline? One could argue a pipeline has many, many more points of failure than a tanker does.
It's actually, in our view, in the risk analysis, it's the opposite. Tankers are a large volume, a million plus barrels of oil, tens of thousands of tons of a very toxic, persistent chemical fluid, and a single-hulled vessel operated by individuals on the bridge that are fallible, with a vessel traffic system theoretically monitoring the tanker's transit. And there's so many different points of potential failure in that it's easy to have a tanker disaster. Pipelines are generally and historically a lot safer way to transport hazardous fluids. Regardless, they decided it was better to build the pipeline across Alaska, have a marine terminal in Valdez, and ship all this North Slope oil out of Alaska on super tankers out of through Prince William Sound. We knew that was a risk. The fishermen locally knew it was a risk. They thought it was inevitable that at some point people would mess up, equipment would fail, human error would come into the system, which is exactly what happened, giving us a catastrophic oil spill that we're still seeing the results of 30 years later.
Well, let's go back to the moment of the spill. What do you remember about that day? When were you first notified?
I got a call. I was the University of Alaska's marine advisor for the region, stationed in Cordova, a small fishing town, not connected by road, but a small fishing town on southeastern Prince William Sound, stationed there for many years prior to the spill. And I got a call early that morning that there was a tanker aground at Bly Reef. And I immediately chartered a plane, got up over the tanker, went to Valdez, landed there. The fumes, even from the oil spilling from the Valdez that morning, were even at 1,000 feet altitude, were pretty, they made your eyes water. There was absolutely no response out there, no containment attempted, which was a promise by the oil companies that they would have an immediate response to such a thing. Landed in Valdez, went immediately, found the Exxon command center that they were just setting up at a coastal hotel there. Walked through the door. There was no security at the time. Introduced myself to the president of Exxon Shipping, and they didn't know a thing about what to do locally. We knew some things locally, and they immediately, with the Coast Guard, the state of Alaska, Exxon, and ourselves, a few local fishing representatives, formed an emergency command team that then directed the response for the first month. But it was obvious. Very soon on, you know, within 2 or 3 days, there was a large northerly wind storm that blew up 70, 80 knot winds that just blew the oil all over every place in Prince William Sound. And there was no containment possible after that. So we knew fairly quickly that this was a catastrophe that could not be responded to effectively.
Years later, knowing that this catastrophe just happened and there was no containment, there also was no real recompense either. You staged a blockade of the sound. How did that come about?
Oh, well, that was a multifaceted effort. It was basically, I think, in 92 or 93, 2 or 3 years after the initial oil spill. And the not only had the wild salmon runs, the hatchery salmon runs, the wild salmon runs failed, but also the hatchery salmon runs failed that summer. And the fishermen could see a very, very dark, uncertain future. Some of it, if not most of it, due to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And the oil company had been very recalcitrant. They didn't want to talk to local people. They didn't want to settle claims. The government had been somewhat ineffective and unresponsive. And so the local seiners, the salmon seiners, decided to blockade Valdez Narrows and not let any more tankers come in or out. It's a pretty dramatic move. It's one of the more, and it turned out to be one of the more effective demonstrations in the history of Alaska, probably anywhere in the history of oil development. So a bunch of seine boats, you know, these 58-foot vessels, about probably 30 or 40 of them, we got them together and they formed a blockade. And several tankers were not admitted, and several that were loading at the port could not exit. And so the tanks at the terminal were filling up. It lasted for a day or two, and it made the point. Secretary of Interior Bruce Babbitt at the time came to Valdez. I was an intermediary between the oil industry, the government, and the fishing industry on this, and it was resolved in a peaceful way. No one was arrested. No one got hurt. The oil industry got put on notice that people were mad, mad as hell, and they were. And the outcome of that was that the government's agreed to sponsor a long-term ecosystem research program in Prince William Sound to try to tease out why these fishery runs were failing and the relationship to the oil spill. As well, there was a promise of habitat protection using the Exxon settlement monies. So it was a remarkably effective demonstration that ended well for all concerned.
This year is the, like you said, the 30th anniversary of the spill. And the impact still lingers. So could you just tell us what's the state of the sound today?
Yeah, here we are 30 years on, and we know now that not only was there severe short-term acute ecological harm caused, which everybody could see with their own eyes with the television and photographic images at the time, but there's long-term and even permanent ecological harm caused by the oil spill 30 years ago. Many of the monitored populations that the governments have monitored scientifically have yet to fully recover. Some, and this is very critical, 4 of them are not recovering at all 30 years later, and that includes pigeon guillemots and marbled murrelets, two small seabirds, Pacific herring, which is a very critical prey resource in the system for seabirds, marine mammals, other fish, and it was also a commercial fishery prior to this bill. And the AT1 killer whale pod, one genetically unique group of orcas that we saw surfacing in the oil in 1989. They lost most of their members of the pod in the next year or two. And now they're down to 6 or 7 members, no reproductive female. So that pod of killer whales is expected to go extinct, period. So not only is there large, severe, short-term, acute injury from these things, but there can be long-term and even permanent harm. The bigger issue as well is that the ecological shift and transition that was caused by the oil spill was like a huge bomb that went off with toxic hydrocarbons in the system. The relationship of the component to the ecosystem changed dramatically, and I think it's pretty conclusive that Prince William Sound will never fully recover from the Exxon Valdez, period. We even still have pockets of Exxon Valdez oil still in the beach sediments of the Sound, but the long-term environmental harm has been dramatic.
So the recovery effort failed. 30 years later, there's still oil on the beaches. You were able to take some of the funding and move it to some place where you thought you could protect. Can you tell me what you did in the forest around the Sound?
Sure. It became very evident about a month into the spill in 1989 that there was very little that could be done to actually clean up or contain the oil. or to help rehabilitate oiled wildlife or try to restore the injured ecosystem. But what we could do is protect it from further additional ecological injury. And ironically, just the year before the Exxon Valdez happened, clear-cut logging had just begun in the very thin strip of coastal temperate rainforest along the coast of Prince William Sound and the North Gulf coast of Alaska. And we knew that that would cause long-term environmental injury. And so we reasoned that certainly we ought to be able to get hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation from Exxon for the environmental harm they caused and use those monies to purchase permanent protections on these coastal forests. That's precisely what was accomplished. The Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council was established with this billion-dollar settlement from Exxon that we had recommended in 1990. The settlement was achieved in 1991, and much of that settlement, probably $400 to $500 million, was used in purchasing these long-term coastal habitat protections to protect these forests. And that there's a couple of logical arguments there. One is this is habitat for a number of the seabirds and salmon species in the streams and coastal herring spawning areas and things like that to protect that. But beyond that, it's a way of compensating for environmental harm that cannot be directly restored. And that's one of the sad things we've learned about oil spills around the world is not only can you not clean them up or contain them, but you cannot really restore an oil spill injured marine ecosystem. What you can do is prevent it from happening again and protect the ecosystem from further immediate harm. And that's what we've done in Prince William Sound.
American Scandal is sponsored by the new masterpiece series, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. Following one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in British legal history, the new masterpiece series, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, is based on the shocking true story of the British Post Office scandal. When money started to seemingly disappear from local branches, the government-owned post office wrongly blamed their own managers for its apparent loss. And for more than a decade, hundreds were accused of theft and fraud. Many were even sent to prison, leaving lives, marriages, and reputations in ruins. But the issue was actually caused by errors in the post office's own computer system, something it denied for years. Don't miss Mr. Bates versus the Post Office, starring Toby Jones, beginning Sunday, April 7th on Masterpiece on PBS. The series will be available to stream on the PBS app, PBS Masterpiece Prime Video Channel, and PBS.org.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes, but let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
In addition to the vast ecological damage, there are the people of Cordova and other towns around the sound. You say that even just 1 month after the spill, it was obvious that very little could be done. I have to imagine in the moment, after the shock, perhaps even the rush of crisis, that this dawning realization struck these towns hard. Can you just tell us what it might have been like to be in Cordova and realizing that their livelihood might be over?
That affected everybody in a devastating way, particularly those small communities within the oil spill region, Alaska Native villages and fishing towns, whose entire self-identity is harvesting fishery resources from the region and also other marine resources, and the whole sense of place was turned upside down. The focus on the future, uncertainties involved in, you know, what the future might be and whether things would restore to normal. And the future was really up in the air. And so there was Cordova became what social psychologists call a toxic community, a corrosive community. There was substance abuse and spousal abuse, and that we had suicides and a lot of anxiety disorders and such. And those persisted for several years. And then you had the litigation on top of that, in which the fishing industry and Alaska Native communities pursued private litigation in U.S. District Court, got a $5 billion punitive verdict a few years later. But then Exxon did what Exxon does, and they appealed it for a decade, whittled it down ultimately to maybe a tenth of that. And so people felt very betrayed by the judicial process. They felt betrayed by government. And so there was this long-term sense of betrayal and anxiety. And I will tell you that the people I know that are in Prince William Sound now will never again trust the oil industry and their promises. So we were successful at Citizens Advisory Council after the oil spill. And so there's a mechanism of communication now between the local stakeholders and the oil industry and the state and federal government that was not there beforehand. So we got things pretty well worked out in Prince William Sound. We have now double hull tankers, a battle vessel traffic system, tug escorts escorting every loaded tanker out through the sound to the ocean entrance, and the Citizens Oversight Council. But what we haven't done is taken that lesson and applied it elsewhere, like the Aleutian Islands and the Bering Strait and during the Arctic shipping season and such. So we've learned our lesson and applied those hard-learned lessons in the sound, but not taken it elsewhere very, very effectively.
Do you know of any who were in Cordova in 1989 who stayed and are there now? How have they rebuilt?
Well, you know, the psyche of the town tends to revolve around the salmon, the fishery economy. And if the fishing has been good, people feel good. They have a restored sense of identity and place and confidence in the future. If fishing has been bad, that confidence and self-identity tends to erode and become a little more fractured. And this last year was a pretty bad year for the Copper River fishery. And that's been a hard hit for the local people there. Plus, they have this residual lingering memory of the Exxon Valdez and how government and industry had made all these promises that they then betrayed immediately upon construction of the pipeline in the 1970s, leading to the Exxon Valdez, which they knew was inevitable if they didn't get it right. So there's this lingering sense of distrust with government and the oil industry, and I think in a very justified way. So people rebuilt in Cordova, and they feel good when there's a good fishing year. But they also know that it's possible to have another one of these. As safe as we've got the oil transport system in the Sound right now, it could happen today again, even with all the safeguards in the system. So that's at the back of everyone's mind as well. And if it happens again, it's just going to be another chaotic few decades for the region. So in hindsight, I think a lot of us feel that the pipeline should never have been built across Alaska. It should have to a marine terminal in Valdez. It should have connected across to Canada, which was the other proposal in the early 1970s, and run through pipelines down to the Midwest. So, but that's hindsight. But we can use some of the lessons of hindsight in how we go forward, I think.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's use the lessons of hindsight. How do we go forward?
Well, I think, when I look back at this in the hindsight of 30 years, I think our glass is about a quarter full and three quarters empty. We've fixed some of the proximate causes of the oil spill in Prince William Sound. Well, now we have, legislated double hull tankers in all the U.S. oil fleets and phase in globally based on our experience here. We have a better vessel traffic system, tug escorts, citizens oversight, better liability regimes, better watchstanding protocols on the bridge of these tankers, all sorts of things in the sound itself, but not we haven't applied those lessons elsewhere in other waterways in the United States. We need to. And then the bigger picture is, in the last 30 years, you know, we've 1989, when the oil spill happened, the world was using about 60 million barrels of oil a day. We knew at the time climate change was a growing risk. Oil was finite. We had to start developing a national energy strategy that would reduce our reliance on this finite, hazardous substance. We called for a national energy strategy at the time, and the governments promptly ignored us. And today, 60 million barrels a day in 1989, today we're using about 100 million barrels a day globally. Energy use has increased about 30%. Atmospheric CO2 has increased from 350 parts per million in 1989 now to over 410 parts per million. We've lost about 30% of the Arctic sea ice in that time period. We've lost thousands of species to extinction. Hundreds of millions of forests have been lost in the, as far as habitat. So the global environmental picture has gone from bad to catastrophic. And we've always hoped that events like Valdez and the Deepwater Horizon, Chernobyl, Bhopal, Fukushima and such would sort of galvanize public consciousness around the short-term injuries that we're causing through our industrial paradigm to the environment, but also in the larger picture to the big chronic cumulative day after day degradation of the, and develop a new economic paradigm that's environmentally sustainable. We have failed on that. And that, you know, we can no longer afford to ignore. So we've got some heavy work, heavy lifting to do on our energy, climate, biodiversity, contaminants, population, resource production and consumption levels to make sure we have a sustainable future. And we have not done that work.
Rick Steiner, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, folks.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, 15% off your first order with code WONDERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
That was my conversation with University of Alaska Marine Conservation Professor Rick Steiner. He helped coordinate the response efforts to the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989. My next guest is Antonia Yuhas. She's an oil analyst, journalist, and author. Her most recent book is Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Antonia spoke to me from a studio at KQED in San Francisco. Antonia Yuhas, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was 30 years ago this year that the Exxon Valdez spilled 11 million gallons of oil into the Prince William Sound. The most recent in public memory spill of that magnitude was Deepwater Horizon. They are similar, obviously, in some ways, that the petroleum hit water, but they are different. One was a tanker spill and one was an oil rig explosion. But I was wondering, as you've covered both, do you think of them as related?
Yeah, they're deeply related in many ways. I think what is similar about these oil spills, you know, I actually wrote a sentence in my book, Tyranny of Oil, about the Exxon Valdez disaster. And I said that one of the reasons was Exxon's failure to adequately prepare for a spill that was not only likely, but probable. I could have written the identical sentence about BP in 2010. What makes these disasters so similar is that they were not only predictable, they were predicted. The companies were warned for years preceding them that the risks that were involved, the dangers, what could lead to the disasters, and then what was necessary to adequately address the failures and the cleanup and the spills after they happened. And in both cases, neither company heeded those warnings, nor did any of their fellow companies, and predicted disaster happened. And that is a tragic outcome, particularly because so many lessons were learned in the wake of Valdez that should have warned regulators that they needed to keep a much tighter tighter wrap on oil companies operating in our waters, be it tankers or drilling for oil in exploration or production, than was the case. And that is one of the reasons why the BP disaster happened. In both cases, the companies were cutting corners, cutting costs, basically playing a very, very risky game with our environment, with the safety of workers and the safety of people who live around those areas and fish from those waters. And all those people and those environments lost out because of a risky game that the companies played.
I'm trying to put on my Exxon or BP hat for a moment. It is obviously a risky game. These spills are not only economic and environmental disasters, but they're PR nightmares, of course. And they're going to get revisited every 5, 10, 25, 30 years. What is it that makes a company as large and capable as these penny-wise and pound-foolish? Why cut corners?
Yeah, I mean, that was almost literally the judgment of Judge Barbier, who ruled in the case against BP, where he found the company grossly negligent and said that they were putting profits, saving time and saving money over people and the environment. And that is exactly the same words also could have been said in the case against Exxon. The reason why they do it is because the costs don't outweigh the benefits. So they, in the case of Exxon, Exxon was incredibly successful at shielding itself from economic harm as a result of the Valdez disaster. Their total cost from their federal government settlement, as well as their cleanup costs, was just $3.4 billion. And a class action lawsuit that was brought against the company by the people of Alaska, fisher folk who were impacted. And originally, they were awarded a $5 billion in punitive damages, which was the equivalent of 1 year's profit for Exxon at that time. Exxon argued the case for 19 years, and they brought that court judgment against them down to just $500 million from $5 billion, and 20 years later. So they ended up paying very little for what were the costs that continue to this day. So fishing is still impacted in Valdez to this day. Oil still seeps up on beaches to this day. And many people are still sick or have died from the impacts of pollution. So for them, there wasn't a significant cost. But there was a number of lessons that were learned as a result of the Valdez disaster that affected policy. So this was a very public disaster, as you say. There were, you know, these incredibly stirring photographs, and it may have been the first really well photographed oil spill in world history. And I think that was very moving for the public. And it did lead to significant policy change. The most important policy change that then impacted the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster was passage in 1990 under the first President Bush of the Oil Pollution Act. And that was an attempt to learn a lot of the lessons of the failures that happened with the Valdez. And that put the federal government in a much more oversight role and driving role than it had been in the after the oil spill with the Valdez, where everything was really just left up to Exxon and there was very little oversight by the federal government. The Oil Pollution Act really changed the law to make it so that BP was forced to almost essentially put everything back the way it was before the disaster, or if it couldn't, pay for what was lost. They had to pay significant fines under the Clean Water Act. They had to alert the public. They had to pay communities that were impacted at the time for losses they were suffering at the time. And there was just a whole host of requirements placed on them that were not there at the time of Valdez and that were there because of legislation that passed as a result. And as a consequence, though I would certainly argue that BP did not end up paying anywhere near what their obligations should have been, they did end up paying in total something around $50 billion, which is, you know, obviously a significant sum of money. And that would not have been the case had we not put in place legislation following Valdez.
All right. I have to do a little math here because I'm interested in knowing what $50 billion is adjusted for inflation in 1989. Boy, a billion has a lot of zeros. Okay. That's fascinating. So in comparison, that $50 billion that BP paid, Exxon paid $3.4 billion in 1989, which is just under $7 billion in 2018 dollars. So that's a 12-fold difference. But by scale, in terms of the just gallons of oil released, that doesn't seem to be, you know, equitable.
It certainly isn't. And I think, you know, in both cases, like I said, neither company paid what the law should have required of them. So in both cases, they negotiated down their fines. If you put in a straight application of the laws they broke under the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, Marine Mammal Protection Acts, they should have faced much higher fines. So BP had itself at the beginning of the disaster actually estimated that it would likely cost $60 billion. And then it came in under that. So BP at the end of the day maybe suffered a few bad years, but they have more than bounced back. And that's because the amount that they were required to pay was, at the end of the day, entirely manageable for them.
Let's turn to some of the better impacts that these two disasters have yielded. Certainly, there's a greater public scrutiny, but also there are some laws and regulations. Can you go through some of the things that have been enacted that actually help and might prevent any of these from happening in the future?
So the most significant legal changes that happened as a result of the Valdez was the passage of the Oil Pollution Act in 1990. And then within that act, there were many significant changes to law. Probably the most significant in the case of tankers was putting in place a requirement that companies shift from single hull tankers to double hull tankers, a double layer of steel, so that it's much, much, much more difficult for those, if it does run aground, if it is impacted, for the oil to be released. And that was in the 1999 Oil Pollution Act. However, it had a very delayed implementation. The companies had all the way until 2015 to fully implement that rule. And the result was, with other more thorough safety requirements put into place, that oil tanker disasters declined dramatically. Now, there are still tanker disasters and oil is still spilled from tankers, but they were definitely reduced by regulation. The other changes that happened were, as a result of the Deepwater Horizon disaster, it was obvious that there was dramatically inadequate oversight for offshore oil companies. And there were some new safety requirements and regulations that were beginning to be implemented. They were written, they were on the books, they were starting to be implemented under the Obama administration, and those were removed by the Trump administration. And the Trump administration has put forward a plan at the same time as reducing regulations and oversight. It's put forward a proposal to open up 96% of all U.S. federal waters to offshore drilling.
So what do you worry about most? What should we be afraid of next?
There's two things that I worry about. Exxon and BP are not only two of the largest oil companies in the world, they're two of the largest companies, period, in the world and in the history of the world. And if these companies can cause this scale of disaster, what is in store in the future as they move into even deeper offshore operations, as they continue to expand much more difficult drilling techniques like fracking, like going into tar sands, as oil becomes more difficult to get at and produce, how much worse could these disasters be, particularly at a time when we have an administration in the United States and now in other countries that are really seeking to aggressively roll back regulations of industry? So in that context, I'm very nervous about what the next disaster might be. But even beyond that, this isn't 1989. This isn't even 2010. We now know that we can't continue. Our climate cannot withstand this continued pursuit of oil without, you know, freewheeling was the language that was used at the time of the Valdez for the behavior of the industry. This type of freewheeling operations, not only can we not withstand it when it's done safely, but we really can't withstand it when it's done unsafely. And we really need to be looking at, in many more contexts, are the costs really worth it? Are we really willing to take in all of this risk and all of these known devastating costs for getting at the last bits of oil?
Antonio Yuhas, thank you so much for talking to us today on American Scandal.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was oil analyst and journalist Antonio Yuhas. You can read more of her work on the oil industry and the BP spill in Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. From Wondery, this is episode 5 of 5 of Exxon Valdez for American Scandal. On our next series, the Hare Krishnas were a movement started with good intentions and a founder who wanted to help a generation of young Americans get closer to divinity. But when that founder died without naming a successor, ambitious followers turned on each other, leading the movement down a path towards crime, violence, and murder. If you'd like to learn more about the oil industry and the BP oil spill, we recommend Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill by Antonio Yuhas. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Sound design by Derek Behrens. This episode was produced by Katie Long. The Exxon Valdez series is written by Benjamin Gray, edited by Andrew Stelzer. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marshall Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.